Welcome to the Fundamentals of Digital Audio.
Welcome to the Fundamentals of Digital Audio Podcast. I'm Jeff Hankerson.
And I'm Pate Snakus.
Pate, we're really glad to have you back as our co-host today.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I'm really glad to be here again as a co-host.
And on the podcast today, we got some great stuff for you. We're going to have part two of the interview with Rick Pepper, who's going to get into the nitty-gritty of the multiband compressor, specifically the AU multiband compressor on the Mac, although it does really apply to multiband compression in general as well for those that aren't on Macs that are using Windows or perhaps even Linux. So we're really looking forward to that. Pate, what do you have for us here today?
My segment will be about field recording. I've been having some experiences with recording in the field, being outdoor interviews or ambient recording, and I'll share my experiences and the tips and tricks I picked up on the way.
Well, that sounds like a great segment, Pate. And that kind of reminds me that I'm going to at some point do a segment about recording live events, because I've been doing some of that at work and have some information to impart about that. Now, I wanted to bring up the topic of compression right out of the bat here, because I've been thinking about it somewhat lately, especially since we've been talking about multiband compression. And it seems to me that as you record your voice and use compression, the compression is going to reduce the dynamic range and boost the, and then you want to go in and boost the overall volume, but you want to do it in a way that doesn't sound harsh. You know, it's almost an oxymoron. You want it to sound loud but not harsh, you know, almost soft and loud at the same time. You know, this is kind of the problem with trying to describe audio with words, but it's, you know, good compression doesn't sound harsh. It sounds, almost has a softness to it. And that got me thinking that, you know, certain frequencies on your voice, you may need to compress them more or give them a, you know, de-emphasize them with an equalizer. And one of the tools that might be helpful in doing that is a spectral analysis tool. And I'll be mentioning a few free ones in our news and notes segment coming up here in a minute. So stay tuned for that. But Pate, what do you think about this? Compression and attenuating certain frequencies more than others.
Yeah, I actually tried a lot to get my own sound a bit better, and I found out that my voice, or actually any voice, has kind of like a sweet spot. So the really nice part in your voice, so to speak. And I set my recording settings to emphasize on that sweet spot, so I will be clear to listen to and pleasant to listen to. That's the my main concern, that people won't turn their headphones down to when they're listening to my voice.
Did you find that you had to emphasize or de-emphasize a specific frequency?
It was around between the 12,000K, no, probably 2K and around 2K, I guess. So 2,000 hertz.
So are you using a equalizer then to help you with that?
Yeah, I at this moment I'm using my hardware compressor, and I so you have this equalizer thing, and I dialed it into that sweet spot and emphasized it a bit with the equalizer.
And how did you find exactly where you needed to emphasize the right frequencies? Was it just trial and error?
Yeah, it was. It was really, for me, it was really hard, like a journey to get this sound, or just to get any sound, which pleased me after recording. So somehow I just played with the knobs and found out that, hey, this really sounded very well. Or yeah, it was amazing to find out while playing that my voice was in this tiny range. When I emphasized it, it was just perfect. It was really like a sweet spot.
Well, I guess that will have to be the homework assignment for all of us. I don't think I've found my sweet spot yet, and I'll have to just keep looking. But let's move over and talk about some news and notes.
Hi there, this is Tony from the Homemade Hit Show at www.homemadehitshow.com. This is your one-stop source for all the best in homemade hits. So if you've got a homemade hit and you want me to play it, send it along, homemadehitshow@gmail.com. Or if you just want to listen to the best music being made in the bedroom, tune in to www.homemadehitshow.com every week.
Back a couple weeks ago on the Inside Home Recording podcast, Derek K. Miller mentioned he had a segment called GarageBand Graduates, and he mentioned a couple of programs that he was using when he just felt like GarageBand wasn't the right tool, and those included Audacity, Fission, Adobe's new Sound Booth, and also the Levelator. And those are all great apps in the right spot, but I wanted to mention another one that I think might be the best one in that group, and it's called Amadeus. It's been around as Amadeus 2 for a long time on the Mac, even going back to Mac OS 8 and OS 9 days, but also now there's a new version coming out called Amadeus Pro, and I gave it a spin. It looks really promising, and we're probably going to have the developer of that application on in a few weeks, so stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, I'll put a link in the show notes so that you can check out Amadeus Pro. There is a free trial version available.
Yeah, I'm looking at this moment at the website, and looking at the screenshots, it just looks astounding. It's very basic, but still, it looks like it's really the minimum tool you can use to just cut up your audio. Looks amazing.
You know, one of the weaknesses of GarageBand is that you only get two insert effects on each channel. So if you want to run an equalizer, like we were talking about in the last episode with Rick Pepper, to get that low-end stuff out of there, you know, below 80 hertz, and then you wanted to run a compressor and then maybe, you know, something else as well, like say an expander gate, and you only got two insert effects, so you either have to skip one of those or you have to export that track out of GarageBand and import it back in so you can run more effects. And that's just kind of a pain. And so what's really nice about this app, Amadeus Pro, is that you can apply as many effects you want to each channel. They're not real-time effects. You know, you have to do it serially, but still, you get both the audio unit and the VST plugins available in this application, and it really looks pretty nice. You know, that kind of reminds me that I wanted to ask our PC users, for those who aren't looking for the real high-end apps, what are you using for an audio editor? You know, what's out there between Audacity and Sony SoundForge or Adobe Audition that you can use to do an effective job that isn't going to break the bank?
I've just heard that lots of people are starting off with the Adobe product like Audition, and I've heard good stories about that. It seems to be a very product with lots of backing of users and programmers.
Yeah, I'm really hearing that Adobe Audition is one of the best audio editing applications out there on any platform. But I'm really looking for something that's more moderately priced, you know, something that's, I think Audition is about $300 US. So I'm looking for something out there between Audacity that's free and Audition that does a great job that people might be using as a lower cost option. You know, another topic that's a little off topic, but not too bad, I guess. I recently, in the Mac Break Weekly podcast, I heard Alex Lindsay talking about his desire to get the perfect iTunes playlist, and he was looking for a way to say he had a gold, silver, and bronze playlist, and he wanted to be able to pull tracks somewhat randomly for each one of those so that he could filter them into a new playlist and combine those in different ways so that he wouldn't always be listening to the same songs. And, you know, I thought, you know, I want to have that too. So I put my nose at the grind and whipped up an Apple script that does pretty much exactly that. Now, it turns out it wasn't exactly what he was looking for, but it was fairly close, and I actually find it quite useful. So what I wanted to do is put that out on the web, and I'll have a link in the show notes where you can do that. And it's almost kind of gives you a way to get radio station-like programming for your iPod. So it's kind of fun. And one of the problems is if you always listen to the same artist and the same CD, you get kind of tired of it. And this gives you a way to get deeper into your music and rotate artists, rotate songs, rotate albums without having to listen to the same ones again and again. You find that you really get deeper in there and enjoy some music that you might not pick out if you were just to look at a bunch of CDs. So give it a try. Let me know what you think. It's an Apple script. It's out on the website, and I'll have a link in the show notes.
Yeah, sounds awesome. Especially the iPod use. So I always have like a certain selection of iTunes or songs that I use at the gym, but I always got the same song. So that sounds amazing. It sounds very useful indeed.
In our last news item here today, we were just talking a minute ago about some spectral analysis tools to be able to see specific frequencies and try to detect where your voice might be too harsh or need to be able to see where your voice might need to be brought up in certain frequencies. And for those that are real pros at this and have a lot of experience, they may be able to just do this by listening and identify frequencies. But for those of us that are not so adept, there are couple of pretty good free spectral analysis plugins in there that will work with audio units and VST, and I'll put a link in the show notes so that you can actually see, you know, where the loudest part of your recording is for your voice or even, you know, even an instrument or something else. And this can really perhaps help us as we're doing our equalization and compression to identify which spots need more attention. So in one of these plugins, I can't remember which one, but one of them you can actually kind of click on a specific band at say 1000 hertz and just hear that frequency, and that's kind of useful. So I'll have some links in the show notes for a couple of freebies, so go ahead and check those out. I think you'll enjoy them.
Sounds like an awesome tool. Sounds like an awesome toy, I mean. Welcome on Metro Station Over Amstel, which is a subway in Amsterdam. And what better place to start a segment on field recording? So the first time I was confronted with a field recorder was a meeting with my friend Simon. He's a cameraman and he just had to show me his new gizmo. And it was a MD recorder with a very curious microphone attached to it. So the microphone was the OKM Soundman, which is a binaural microphone, which pretty much means you put one microphone in one ear and the other microphone in another ear, just like earbuds, and it records exactly what you hear. So in the same experience, so if you replay the recording, you get this really, really immersive sound. And once I heard that, I was just amazed and I wanted to do that. That was the moment that I really started thinking about making my own field recordings. And being an audiophile, that's just, it was just amazing. I was really, really curious. So I started reading in and reading about in forums and etc., and started collecting all kinds of information on how I could record such audio. And so I came up with a few recorders, a few microphones, and a few headphones that are really nice to record field recordings, because those are the main ingredients in making a decent field recording. So let me just give you an overview in the stuff you can use for making a field recording. And let's just start with the recorders. You don't have to invest lots and lots of money. You can start out really, really cheap. For example, you can just buy for about $10 or $20 a memo recorder. And memo recorders are actually quite nice recorders. They're very small and they can record in stereo. So you just plug in a decent external microphone and you got a really, really nice field recording set. So of course, this all depends on what kind of recording you want to make. I mean, if you want to interview somebody, you need some other microphone than if you would want to make an ambient recording or a stereo recording. So I'll just give you a few examples, even in quality of recorders, of course. First, a few microphones. If you want to make an ambient recorder, there are two very nice options. You've got a Soundman of OKM, which is very nice, and I think it's just about $200 or something. And you got the Audio Technica Pro 24, which is actually a Handycam microphone, so you can mount it on your video camera. And so the Audio Technica is quite cheap, actually. It's about $50, and it's really nice stereo sound. And so those are the ambient recorder microphones. But you can also, if you want to interview somebody, there's nothing better than a reporter microphone. And you got a few, but I'm pretty much hooked on Sennheiser. Sennheiser is a German brand and it's got just amazing microphones and headsets. So I'm hooked on both. So both the microphones and the headsets. And the reporter microphone they've got is the MD42, and I've got one too. It's a very nice omnidirectional, which means you can record pretty much all the sounds. It doesn't focus on just the thing that's in front of the microphone, but also a bit on the a bit of ambient sounds. So it's very sturdy and it's very long, but it's mono and it's very nice. You've also got a cardioid microphone, which means it picks up mostly the thing that's in front of it, which is the MD46, I think. So very, very nice microphones. So there are two other microphones you can use in field recording. One of them is a lavalier microphone, so that's the one you pin up on your jacket, and which are pretty nice. There are also some stereo examples of them, and leading brands in that are Sony, Sennheiser, Rode, and some other major microphone brands. And the other one, which might surprise you, is the headset. So you've got all these headsets made for Skype and for iChat and for some other recording or chatting with people. But the headsets also make a very nice microphone if you just want to record yourself in the field. It will pick up on some ambient noise, and it might even pick up on, for example, the person you are talking to. So some very nice headsets are the Sennheiser PC160 and the Plantonic DSP500, and those are just very nice microphones with quite good microphone quality. They're not as good as the reporter microphones or the ambient microphones I mentioned before, but they're quite good. Okay, so on the other end of the microphone, you must have a recorder. And I mentioned the memo recorders, but there are more options and even cheap ones as at that. So you might consider buying an iRiver, which is actually an MP3 player, but you can also record sounds with it at quite high quality, actually. And another MP3 player is the iPod, which can also record stuff, but you have to extend it with a Belkin universal microphone adapter. And I think you can only record with from a fourth generation iPod. So it doesn't work with a Nano, I think. So another option, which my friend Simon had, was a Sony MD recorder. And these are quite pricey. I mean, they can be like $100, but but they can also be about $200 and over. So you really have to check out which recorder you need. The one important thing is that you make sure that you get a recorder with an amplified microphone jack. So that way your external microphone will work. If you just got a line-in jack, the MD recorders will have to need an external amplification of the microphone signal. Okay, so those are the cheap options. Now we'll get to the very expensive options, which are the semi-professional recorders. And those are mostly solid-state recorders, which means they record on flash cards. So you got the M-Audio Microtech, and you got the Zoom H4, which is promoted on the Samsung website, I think. And you got an Adderall R9, which is actually a Roland. I think Adderall is a Roland brand. So all three are very, very nice recorders. They all record on flash cards, I think. And they all have very, very nice quality. But they're not professional recorders. And you will know because there are some compromises. Every recorder I just mentioned has its compromise. So the M-Audio Microtech is a bit slow, and it's got a built-in battery which runs very. It's got a very short life, and the Zoom H4 is quite bulky, and the Adderall R9 it records on quite low quality. That's all relative. I mean, low quality would be CD quality or something. I think the recorder that makes the most chance of lasting you more than 3 years, I think, is the Zoom H4, which is a pretty new recorder. I've got the M-Audio Microtech, and I'm very satisfied, except for the sloth of the device. It boots very slow. So the one option which is left is the Marantz PMD660. That's a very bulky but very, very sturdy and very professional recorder, and it's used by many, many podcasters. So those were the recorders. The final thing I can say to you, when you record, make sure you have a decent headphone. So there will be a headphone which is a closed system, so no ambient sounds will seep into your ears, and you just hear the thing that you record. And another thing which is very important is a plop screen. So if you want to save your recordings from wind sounds and from other external influences, you'll just have to have a decent plop screen on your microphone. And basically, after that, you got a decent recording. And the only thing you can do afterwards, which is in almost all case of external or field recording, which is post-production, you just always need to filter out all the noise and all the wind noise, etc., and microphone handling, which is quite hard, and that just needs fiddling. You just need experience with that. So just go out and play, and enjoy. So if you need any information about me or my podcast, please go to www.sneaker.fm. So that's it, and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Last podcast, we had part one of our interview with Rick Pepper, where he explained the first few steps in speech processing, and the first one being to do either a high pass filter or just using a graphic equalizer to remove everything below about 80 hertz, so that you don't have that low energy stuff in your voice in the vocal track that you don't really want and you don't need. So that was the first step, and then we got into talking about a multiband compressor, and really the idea is that you divide the frequencies up into three or four bands, let's just say three for the sake of simplicity, low, mids, and highs, and you can press each one individually. And we've got some screenshots up at the website, digiaudio.blogspot.com, for you to find more on this, because you may want to refer to these screenshots as Rick is talking about exact settings that he's using in different spots in the multiband compressor. And then he goes on to talk about how to get a little sparkle with a kind of an RL Exciter plugin, and using a dynamic processor for a little bit of expander gate action and a little more compression. So I think you're really going to enjoy it. So without further ado, here's the rest of our interview with Rick Pepper. Now, so I'm looking at a picture of a screenshot of the AU multiband compressor. So this is available to anyone who uses GarageBand or really any audio program that's even Audacity that supports AU plugins on the Mac. If you're on the PC side, I'm going to have a link to a free VST plugin for anyone who wants to play with that one and doesn't have that in their audio editing application. So now, one of the first thing I see here in the parameters for the AU multiband compressor is the pre-gain and the post-gain, and I mean, I don't necessarily understand why you have both of those things. You know, why not just have post-gain? What's going on with those?
A person could just normalize the signal, and then in theory that gives you the same max starting point for every track that you might have to deal with. But I can imagine, depending upon what you're working with for an original, or maybe what's adjacent to it, or if the signal is really dynamic, that might be one way to get the signal pulled up to more of an operating range, even though the range on those controls, like for the threshold is mainly one we'd be talking about, those go down fairly low. But if you were dealing with something for some reason that you couldn't normalize, didn't want to normalize, or the majority of the track was just, you know, totally in the basement and there's hardly anything there, except for a couple spikes, which messes up your normalized process. Right. That's one way to pull the signal up before it passes it through the rest of the system, the rest of the parameters there, so that it gets it up into an operating range. That's one way to look at it, is pull it up to operating range.
All right, that makes sense.
And then the post gain is, now that you've added a bunch of attenuation from your compression, you could do a normalize after the fact. And in digital, I don't believe, I mean, maybe some tech at Bias or Digi could tell me different, but I don't believe there's really any difference where you make the gain up at, because once you're in the digital realm, you're burning up bits. Every 6 dB that you have to boost it, you've thrown away a bit of resolution. So I don't think it matters where you pick that gain up from once you're in the computer. Okay. So you could just do a normalize afterwards, or if you're doing a chain of plugins like I've got it, it's good to bring it back up to, quote-unquote, an operating level before you go shove it through the rest of your stuff.
Okay. And then you actually have your tack time set here to zero, and your release time set to 0.11 seconds. So you're being really aggressive there. And you know, what's the thinking behind that? I don't usually see them up that high for voice processing. So what's going on there?
I want to attack the peak, since that's the part I'm trying to treat the most. I want to get a hold of it as quickly as possible, and pull it down. Whereas if you let it take longer, the peak has probably gone by already by the time it responds to it. So I want to hit it right away. As soon as it's there, I want to pull it down. And then the release time, I haven't spent a lot of time, especially in software, playing around with extending the release time. But the idea is, if I'm attacking that quick and there's short peaks I'm worried about, then I'll release it that quickly.
Okay.
As well.
Now, are you in danger there of getting some pumping because you're releasing it so quickly, or have you not really found that to be a problem?
I have not seen it to be a problem. Now, it could be that I could pull my threshold down further and attack it, do more aggressive from that perspective if I backed off my release time. That I have not specifically experimented with, but I certainly am aware of the pumping, and hopefully in those samples I've got out there and you listen to them, you didn't hear any of that. I'm not hearing any of it.
No.
But yeah, that's your public enemy number one with your compression, is that you start to generate anomalies because of what you're doing.
Okay. Now the next group of setting are your three crossover points, and you have them set at 120 hertz, 700 hertz, and 5,330 hertz. And if I'm understanding this correctly, this is where you're separating the signal into the different frequency ranges. So everything from 0 to 120 hertz is being sent to one set of compression levels, and then everything from 121 to 700 hertz is to another compressor, essentially, and then everything from 7,000 to 5,330 is that one, and then you have the fourth one that's the high end, that's everything that's left. Do I have that right, or do I have the, is that not quite?
That's correct. That's exactly
okay.
How it is.
And so why these points, why at these different, why at 120 hertz, 700 hertz, and 533 hertz, and, instead of something else? What's the thinking behind that?
I just use the gentle preset. And that 700 happened to be where it ended up at. Now, a person could probably get some more mileage out of tweaking that even more. My main concern, at least for my voice, is the bottom one. You don't want to bring it up too high. There's a balancing point there where you want to get a good management of the extreme low end, where it can really get rumbly and excessive real quickly if it's not managed well. So you don't want to bring that point up too high, because a lot of times what I do is and I think that's how it is in that example, I have that set almost like a limiter so that it only responds to peaks and then just smashes them to death. And that's just to respond to plosives or any other errant stuff that shouldn't be there. So if you bring it up too high, then it starts to compress the lower mid bass, which starts to add the thickness, especially to male voices. So you don't want to grab that too much at the same time.
The first crossover point from 0 to 120 hertz is being sent to this first compressor, if we can call it that. And in this compressor, there are three settings. There's a threshold, the headroom, and the EQ. And you have it set here for minus 74 dB threshold, which, and this is a little confusing to me, because in a more standard compressor, you'd set it to more something like, if you're just using one single compressor, your threshold, you'd probably set it a lot higher than that. So,
right.
What's going on there?
The reason I set that low, that's how low I needed to set it to get it to respond the way I needed. I wanted it to respond to manage the low on, and this is on my voice in that case there. But you would normally set it a lot higher. That was just what I needed to get it to trip where I wanted to trip.
Okay.
To get the tone I was after.
And you have a pretty bassy voice. So someone that has kind of a more mid ranging voice, might not need it down that low.
Right. Now it depends. Yeah. It that, and this is where I was going to, where I could say that the multiband is one way to attack certain groups of problems, especially when you're looking at that low band like that versus EQ. If you EQ, you're adjusting the way it is all the time. And if you're trying to adjust it to deal with, let's say, 10% of the time, either the person got way too close to the mic or there's a couple of plosives or something like that, you're sacrificing what it could sound like the other 90% of the time.
Right.
So if you use the multiband, what you're able to do is maintain that thicker texture the 90% of the time. And then if you set that thing up like a limiter, it just responds for you dynamically, because what you're dealing with there isn't a tonal anomaly, you're dealing with a dynamics anomaly. Mm. So setting it up like a limiter, it responds to those couple plosives or those couple errant rogue waves, whatever they are, and deals with them. But the texture for the rest of the time is nice and thick. So the EQ putting in front of it is just totally trash the stuff I know I don't need. And then on my voice and in my recording situation, I don't have any problem with plosives or any of that stuff. I have an isolation booth in my basement and foam all around the walls and everything, and the windscreen on the mic itself and a pop filter. So I really don't have trouble with that, but I'm a little obsessive that way. So I trash those bands anyway. Okay. But I've heard a lot of podcasts where there's just so much garbage down there. If they would just throw the multiband on there and smash that bottom band or dump the EQ, it would make such a difference to clean it up. And like I said, on computer speakers, you never know the difference, but you go play it on a car stereo with any guts to it, and man, it's like the windows are going to get blown out.
So I guess I don't really still completely understand why threshold has to be way down there, but I'll take your word for it that that's just at the point where it would kick in. It would just seem to me that if you wanted to limit, you'd want it to be more like at -1 or -2 or something like that, instead of way down on the other end. I'm a little bit confused about that.
I think the reason that I ended up with that on those samples, and I didn't think a lot about the fact that that might cause confusion for folks, because the SM-81 has a low roll-off on it, a two position. I have it maxed. And then I'm using a DBX 286, just old school mic processor preamp that has an 80 hertz on it, which you don't truly get the cascading effect when you do it that way. So it's not like I've got, 36 dB per octave at 80 hertz or something, but I have it on just because I can. And so the content is probably fairly well controlled by the time I get it into software.
Okay.
And so I'd have to go back and play it on the Mac again and look at it and see what kind of response I was getting out of the compressor at that point, to see if it was really actually even doing much.
Okay. So,
but you're absolutely right. Conventional thinking would be that you actually end up setting it a little bit lower than you would think, but certainly not that low.
Okay. So, so basically the answer there is that you've already got stuff pretty much taken care of it, and you're just really worried about those really bad plosives. Now the headroom setting, is that kind of mean like digital ceiling? This is almost like limiting. Is that what that's doing there? So that if you have this set at for the low range, you have it at 1.2 dB, so it's not gonna go past that, or what's going on there? I'm not sure I understand what headroom is here.
This is pretty bad in one regard, in that I'm working with the stuff. I get the response I'm after. I get the desired effect. But in a traditional compressor, there's no such thing as headroom. It's threshold, ratio,
right,
and then you might have attack and release on a your typical Behringer two channel is going to have all four. The four band, the four channel is just going to have the threshold release and then output gain. And so I believe, I could be wrong, so somebody might think I'm a lunatic, but
when you have the least amount allowed on this podcast, it's okay.
That's good. I believe you could look at it as, I think of it as headroom, meaning this is how much room there is before it's going to start to respond, or how hard it's going to respond. I should say that's what threshold is when, but how hard is your ratio? And furthest to the left on the audio units plug-in is the highest ratio.
Okay.
I believe that's the way to, that's when I work with the controls, that's the way I get it to respond. When I want limiting, I raise the threshold and I reduce the headroom, quote unquote. And if I want something more average, then I'll relax the headroom and adjust the threshold accordingly.
Okay. And, you know, also on a stand, and the last thing in here is this EQ, and I'm also not really, just like you said, on the headroom in a standard compressor, you don't have any kind of EQ settings. So what's going on with that in this particular compressor here?
It's real interesting when I look at software, and not that, you know, I've only been in this stuff about 20 years. I can't imagine what the guys have been doing this for 40 years thinking some of the way some of the software stuff is set up. So I defer my response to surely what's a greater response from those folks. But I don't know why on earth they labeled headroom headroom. It should be ratio, because on a real compressor, that's how it's labeled. Because okay. Some of the stuff just doesn't translate. I don't get that. And yet I see things in like video, which I have a lot less experience with, like in Final Cut Express. And I think, I don't care if that follows the old school way of doing it. This just doesn't make any sense. Why are you making me do this? So anyway, on the compressor there, the threshold, headroom, and EQ, I don't know that I can think offhand of a better way they could label it, but what it is you can adjust the output of that band of that we're dealing with, that band of the spectrum. You can add it or subtract it.
Okay, so
from your mix. So if we go back to my first analogy of take a three-way electronic crossover, feed three discrete compressors, mix them back together, this is tweaking the fader level of one of those coming back into the main mix.
So a better word might be gain, actually, right?
That's what's happening. But because it does affect the tonal texture like an EQ, I can see where they would want to label it that way for people, because that's kind of the net effect, is it changes the equalization in a big way.
Right. So if you take and so you're boosting that one. So, and I noticed that as I was playing with this, is that if I, in this first crossover level, was if I pumped that up, I got more bass, and so that makes sense. Okay, I gotcha. So
the reason I'm pumping up is because I'm smashing it so hard. I want to make sure that it still stays in there, so that the texture most of the time is what I want. And that's an easy way to do it. I mean, you just grab the whole everything below 120 hertz and pull it up a little bit.
Okay. This is starting to make some more sense now, so this is very helpful. And so as we move into the other three, I guess they're thinking of them as individual compressors, you're doing more compression in the mid-range as you have your you know, between 120 and 700 hertz. I don't know if that's still mid-range. I guess it's still fairly low, mid to low.
Low mid.
And you're doing headroom. Now, I'm actually glad you let me know that I could kind of relabel that as ratio, because that makes a lot more sense to me. So it's a, you know, 6.6 there, and you have your threshold more at about minus 49, and not touching EQ either. How did you arrive at those settings? It's just by ear again?
Yeah, that's, and if I, you know, again, I just threw these up this afternoon.
Right.
The good thing about all this with the audio thing is ultimately the proof is in the pudding. So it's like somebody says, hey, this is the way to do it. And you listen to their sample, you're like, man, that just stinks. You can basically just write them off.
Well, this is why, this is why I'm asking you so many questions, because as nice as it would be to have this be a template that you could use for anybody, you know, it just doesn't work that way.
That's right. That's very right.
You know, my voice, I don't think, is as bassy as yours. So I think that, you know, depending on what I'm trying to achieve, I probably won't be able to use the exact same settings as on mine. But regardless, it's good to get an idea, have a starting point, and then start to understand what's going on with this stuff.
Now, I never thought of this, but the good news is with what I give you on this page, I could have put a little bit higher res raw file out there than the 64K, so you'll have to put up with the encoder artifacts, but a person could download both copies, the raw and the processed, and set all their settings just like this on the raw and check and see if that's what they get, if it sounds like what my processed copy sounds like.
Yeah.
So I've given them everything they need to know to replicate what I got there, assuming they think that it sounds good.
Right. And just so folks know, Rick put up some before and after samples so that you could hear the difference, you know, from the dry recording and in the processing he's doing. So as we're looking more, I guess, at the mid-range, again, you're doing heavier compression there. And is that just because the mid-range can as you're pumping the volume up, be provide some more harshness? So you got to make sure that that gets attenuated a little more. Is that kind of what you're trying to achieve, or am I off base there?
See, and we're looking at EQ3 or EQ4.
I'm looking at 3.
3, yeah. My voice is not very mid-rangey.
Okay.
So normally on more people I've dealt with than less, I'll put it that way, I would be dealing with this a little bit more aggressively. I'd have the headroom a little bit lower, so the ratio higher, to respond a little bit more harshly, because that's where most of the offense is at. On my voice, there's not nearly as much there.
Yeah, I noticed that with my voice, I have to be careful. In fact, sometimes I'll EQ down around 3,000. And I don't know if it's my voice or the microphone I'm using, or maybe both. I'm using one of these Blue Snowball USB mics, which, you know, they're okay. They're very convenient, because you just plug it in and go. And the sound is, you know, for the price of getting a halfway decent microphone and analog to digital conversion all built in the one, it's not too bad. But that being said, if you even bought a condenser or even dynamic mic that cost the same, you know, about $150, and put it through a, you know, even a mixer or something, you'd probably get better sound. But anyways, I kind of find that I have to bring the mids down just a little bit so that I don't get too much harshness there.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I find, that there's far more people with voices like that than the ones that sound like they have a built-in disco smile on them.
Then over on the high end here, you're really just not doing very much, you know, on your headroom or ratio. It's just 0.1. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's my de-esser. And again, mainly because I could. It was there. Because I have a de-esser on the DBX 286 that I'm feeding through. But I did not, for the sake of trying to make sure that most of the adjustment was done in software when I recorded these examples. I might have forgot to shut that one off. But on the USB, since that's direct USB, that didn't go through there. That's definitely very pertinent for the USB mic, which really did need it, because it's got its own pre-emphasis there, whether mechanically by design on the capsule or if they actually have some equalization on the audio conversion on that thing.
Okay. All right. So I guess, you know, that's really helpful. It still seems kind of confusing to me why the thresholds are down around minus 50 or lower. But I guess I'm going to have to keep trying to understand that and play with that some more. Just because when, like I was saying before, when I go use a standard compressor, I, you know, maybe even set it at minus 10 or minus 15 or something. So it just seems a little odd, but it just seems like this tool works a little bit differently. So.
Well, the other thing would be on your, as much as this is supposed to be about how it sounds, and ultimately that's the acid test, is does it sound good? I still really rely a lot on the meters, on these plugins, to give me some sort of reality check, knowing roughly where I think I want to end up with for attenuation, compression. And that's in order to get the deflection I'm looking for, that's where I had to go for a threshold. So I'd really be curious, when you're processing yours, for instance, for this podcast, when you set your threshold there, check and see what kind of deflection you get on your gain reduction.
Okay.
And see if you're, I would say you'd want to get at least, I don't think I ever go beyond 7 to 10 dB on any one of these or on the standard dynamics processor. So that's a little bit less than half deflection on the full scale of those meters.
Right.
Because unless you got a really esoteric room, mic, and preamp, you're going to really start asking for trouble, because all your noise floor is going to come way up, and all your little clicks and clothes rustling and everything else is going to go through the roof.
Okay.
So I'd be curious to see, have you check that out when you're doing it and see what you notice.
Okay. That actually helps too, because if you think that your mid range should be getting some compression, for example, and you're not seeing that come in on the readout, on the level meters, then you need to adjust your threshold in one direction or the other to affect it. So okay, that makes some sense. Looks like the next thing you're trying to do is kind of like some oral exciter stuff, where you're trying to put some sparkle back into it after compressing it. And in the tool that you've reached for is the MDA Bandisto plugin, which that's a free plugin, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
it's
a freebie.
It's a VST plugin?
Correct.
Okay, so, unfortunately for those of us that don't have a copy of Peak or something else that supports VST, we might have to... we might be able to use this one, but I suppose Audio Hijack does, but that's kind of inconvenient the way you'd have to process that.
I got to thinking I should have dug up a link for, I'm sure there's someplace you can download these, since I know there is, because I ran across them, to download these just so that people who do have VST, if they don't have, because Peak ships with it.
Right.
And they're using some other tool that supports VST so that they know where to go to get it.
Well, I mean, if you didn't have this available to you, if you only have audio units, AU plugins available, would you do any kind of EQ to kind of bring up some high end again, or would you just kind of skip this step? What would you do in lieu of this if you didn't have this available?
Yeah, I suppose it really depends upon what it sounds like after it goes through that multiband and that pseudo de-essing. That's what a de-esser is. I shouldn't say pseudo. That is what a de-esser is a filter-fed compressor, so that it only responds to one specific frequency band.
Right.
And when you adjust you're just adjusting the center frequency of the filter that comes into that's like a side chain, I believe. So it just responds to that band. So that is exactly what we're doing with that fourth band there. I guess it would depend upon, this is one of those things where it's kind of an obsession thing where, because I can, to really try and get that sizzle on there.
Right.
And that's the one thing that's really unique. Now, part of this that's kind of insane, and I mean, Aphex came out with this in the 80s, if I remember rightly. The insane part of it is that the way it does what it does, and that's why that I've seen some plugins now for iTunes that have this basic thing, is it's generating harmonics by causing distortion.
Okay.
So there's actually this, and that's why they give you they're labeled distortion, which is kind of like a drive level to control how much distortion you're getting. Because when you distort, which is what makes an electric guitar sound like it does, you're generating harmonics, first, second, third, fourth harmonics, which adds content that's not, it's not just amplitude based like equalization is. It's actually creating new content because it's generating harmonics, which is why I was really excited to see this plugin for iTunes come along. Because that's the thing with the MP3s, the high end is treated so harshly, even though the plugin indiscriminately generates harmonics, at least gives you the effect that you've regained some of the content again. Because it's not just amplitude, because the encoder is stripping away content. It's just not there. And this distortion actually creates it.
What's the name of that plugin?
Rather
don't remember? Well, if you think of it later, let us know.
I will. So if I didn't have this, I don't recall exactly what my voice sounded like without it. It probably was fine, but if I really had an issue with it, I probably would have maybe thrown the graphic in there again, or just the parametric, which just gives you a single band to work with. I maybe would have done that, but this was more one of those because I can deals.
All right.
To really put it over the top.
And then the last thing you're doing after this Bandisto plugin is it looks like you're going through the dynamics processor again. So essentially we're compressing again. So why don't we have enough compression with the multi-band compressor? Why are we trying to compress again? Are we just trying to max it out, or why can't we max it out at that stage? What's going on with this?
We could probably run the multi-band harder and get the same effect. And I haven't done a lot of A-Bing with this that I can really say, yeah, in this experiment, I'd try these settings and sat down and spent a lot of time A-Bing. I mean, I got 6 kids. I don't have a lot of time to A-B.
Right,
you know?
I understand.
So, part of the thinking being you're going through the multi-band and presumably you're smashing each band, not necessarily down to the same general amplitude, but you're treating them each individually, and now you've got maybe a more quote-unquote normalized, spectrally normalized signal to work with. And now I just want to put just a little more spank on it, as one engineer, mastering engineer, said, you got to spank it a little. But the main reason, actually, I threw this in here was to use the gate.
Oh, okay.
And you'll see I've got my expansion ratio lifted up a little bit, and then the threshold, so that I'm getting some gating to help pull down any errant environmental artifacts to try and keep it nice, clean, nice, try to keep it nice and tight.
Like your PowerBox fan coming on, for example.
All right, exactly.
Okay. And so this is, again, a minus 90 dB. I mean, actually, this is curious that the threshold and the expansion threshold, you know, for gating is at minus 90, because it would seem to me that if I just did a ambient recording of the room I was in, that it would, you know, maybe peak around maybe more like minus 45 or something like that. So why, you know, do you have just a better environment perhaps? I mean, I'm just recording in my living room here, so, you know, it's not, I've got a couple of pillows in front of me, and that's the extent of my treatment. So is that just because, you know, you said you have a spot in where you have it, you know, the sound, where it's sound treated fairly well, that you have it all the way down at minus 90?
I'm sure that's some of it. Some of it is also I've just passed it through another compressor, so I've reduced the signal level.
Okay.
I have the post gain on that multiband brought up a little bit. I'll just throw this in real quick. This is something I have noticed when you chain effects like this, especially when you have ones that have output gain controls like the multiband does and the dynamics processor does. I'll put it this way. I hear artifacts that if I was dealing with hardware components, I would say I'm clipping the input to the next component in the chain.
Right.
So that's the reason I don't lift the multiband output any higher.
Okay, so you can.
Now, I suppose if I added these effects, one, I ran it through and listened to it with just the one in there, or the EQ and the multiband, and adjusted it so that my meters and peak just go up to zero, you'd think it would survive it going through the next stage. I don't actually go through that methodically and do it, but that's one of the reasons I don't make more of the gain up in the multiband stages, so I don't clip the next two stages.
Okay, so that... So you're doing it in two parts here, just to hopefully avoid being too harsh, basically.
And the gate. I was really after the gate. Okay. That's
now for those of us that are just using GarageBand. You know, it's kind of funny for me because at work I have more tools at my disposal. I actually have Peak at work and Soundtrack Pro, so I can put on as many effects as I want, but those of us who are using GarageBand, like I use at home, can only use two effect inserts on one track. So, you know, without having, I suppose you could, you know, you're running about four, I think, here, so you could do two and then export it out as an, you know, process file and import it again and run two more effects, but that's really a bit of a pain. So for folks who are trying to deal with this with just two effects, I mean, what would you just hit the multiband compressor a little harder then, and then maybe run a limiter on the master track, or how might you try to? You know, it's not necessarily ideal, but for those that are trying to accomplish it in GarageBand, you know, how might you approach that?
Oh, you could probably get 90% of the way there. If it was me, my first plugin would be the graphic.
Mm-hmm.
dump the bottom end, treat the high end if you need to, adjust the mid-range if you need to, and then the multi-band. And I'd say you get 90, 95% of the way there. I'll put it this way. The podcast, like I said a couple times, the podcasts I've listened to, and maybe I'm just obsessive, but, you know, I've listened to them in enough other environments, and I hear these artifacts, I'm thinking, all you got to do is dump three bands on the EQ and it'll fix that. But dump those bottom bands in the graphic and pump it through the multiband, and it'll sound tons better than many of them out there.
And do you usually find that after you do all this processing, you still need to run a limiter or not?
No.
At what point is it too much? You know, with these settings, are we smashing it too hard? Where we're making it less desirable to listen to? I mean, really, because really in podcasting, we don't need to necessarily try to sound just like radio. You know, we can.
My thing with speech is, and think of it in terms of like printing and color and photography, where you got color gamut. I try to smash my stuff down to fit into the gamut of what I think the playback systems are going to be. And the things that I include, especially when I'm thinking sermons for my church, I think, will they be able to listen to this going down a gravel road in their car, two kids yelling in the back seat? Are they going to be able to follow along?
That's a pretty high standard that you hold yourself to.
And I haven't actually tested that, so I don't even know that I'm meeting it, but so I go to the extreme edge because...
Wait a minute, you've got all these kids. Why haven't you tried it out?
Yeah, I could. I have the test environment, but I haven't utilized it. But that's my thing. There's nothing more annoying than trying to listen to speech and they just disappear on you. And my thing is, I don't know what they're going to listen to this on. You know, I don't know how many people anymore have time to sit down and listen on a pair of magnapans in a room with total dead silence to hear every little nuance. If they do, great, more power to them. I just know I don't have that kind of time. So it's kind of like almost like our lives. It's like I have to squish the gamut down on this because the gamut of the time I got left in my life for it, pretty small, so I got to be able to fit it in. So that's philosophy number one. Second thing is, too much, a measure of too much is when whatever you've got for environmental limitations, if it starts to cause, because the side effect of compression is you have to bring the level back up so that when you, if you normalize, you bring in the whole signal back up now. So your noise floor comes up, your bat, which means your environment starts to show. And if you don't have a required environment, you're going to have a lot of artifacts and stuff showing through that you don't want. So that's how you know you got too much. The other one is, it is possible to get some pretty funky tonal, and it can sound overdriven. It can just sound so excessively over the top.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Fundamentals of Digital Audio. I'm Jeff Hankerson, and special thanks today to Rick Pepper for being our interview guest and helping us out with speech processing. We really appreciate that. Maybe we'll have Rick back at some point on another topic. And thanks once again to our co-hosts, Pate Snangus of the Sneaker.fm podcast. Go over to Sneaker.fm to check out Pate's other podcast, and I think you really enjoy it. I am subscribed and recommend that you do too. You can find us on the web at digiaudio.blogspot.com, where you'll find all our show notes and links to subscribe in iTunes or other podcasting clients. So if you're a new listener, and I know that we've had a number of new listeners lately, I really want to thank you for coming along and checking out the Fundamentals of Digital Audio, and I do encourage you to subscribe. You'll find the links on the website. That's going to do it. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to the Fundamentals of Digital Audio podcast. If you have questions or comments, send them to digiaudio.podcast@gmail.com. That's digiaudio.podcast@gmail.com. MP3 voice comments are welcome. Be sure to visit digiaudio.blogspot.com for show notes and links to great articles on audio production. We'll see you next time on the Fundamentals of Digital Audio.